If you've not been with us previously, we've been looking at types and shadows of Jesus in the Old Testament and then looking into the New. I want to reverse it. I think it was Bishop Augustine that once said that the New is in the Old concealed and the Old is in the New revealed. You can figure that one out as you go along. But I want to go into the New and look back into the Old. It's just the reverse of what we have been doing. But first of all, just something that will only apply to a small minority of you this morning. I'm kind of looking around to see who it just might apply to. You will be a very elite and special group. Anybody recognize these things? Anybody put their hand up if you recognize them? Yes, one, two, three, four, five. I told you it was elite, didn't I? Yeah, right. These are a useless form of identity card that was issued between 1939 and 1952 to all newborns. So your parent, your carer, your guardian, whoever, would have to go and register you and get one of these cards. They were useless. All that's on them is your name, a very brief address, and a rubber stamp. That's all. I didn't even realize I had one. This is mine. Now, I discovered this at my sister's funeral just a few weeks ago, when my nephew had been responsible for clearing out her belongings and selling her property and so on, and came across this, along with some old photographs. And what this did for me was filled in some gaps, childhood gaps. I knew the house in which I was born. I think I've seen it once since. And then there's the house that I have the first recollection of when I would have been about three. And one of the main reasons I remember it is that one Saturday morning, the local policeman, the farm foreman, and the bailiff all arrived and we were evicted. That's a lovely memory to have at three, three, isn't it? But my mum used to mention other places that I had the clue about, but they're all on here. And between 1947 and 1951, I lived in six houses. Now, we weren't so much nomadic as chaotic. And I think probably a little bit dysfunctional as well, but I'll leave that with you. Jesus, too, had an ID card. And you find the record of his ID card in both Matthew and in Luke. They consist of his family record that goes back from the Old Testament, from the New into the Old, and the other one is the reverse way round. I want us just to share these readings together. The first one is Matthew, and if you read with me, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Now you can read on. Come on, you're not trying, are you? Come on. That's the idea. Okay, this is Jesus' genealogy. It goes from Abraham to Joseph. There's a lot of folk in there. There are three groupings of 14. And then there's one in Luke, if you bring that one up, James. When Jesus began his ministry, at about 30 years of age, being the son, as was supposed, of Joseph, the son of Heli. And then it goes on and takes you back to Adam and to God. This is Jesus' genealogical record. In our series, Did You See Me Then?, we've been going the other way round. But it's not just an exercise in tracing Jesus via the Old Testament. It's rather about finding or discovering ourselves in the whole of his life cycle, his ministry, and his presence. So where is our place, our ID, in that family tree? Because it's not just his past. This is about our future. This is about our present as well. For this first bit, I just want to conclude with a reading that I think very cleverly condenses the Jesus, not of his genealogy, but of his life in those 33 years. I was reminded of this in conversation with Jonathan a couple of weeks ago. He was born in an obscure village, the child of a peasant woman. He grew up in another village where he worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30. Then for 3 years, he was an itinerant preacher. He never wrote a book. He never held office. He never had a family or owned a home. He didn't go to college. He never wrote a book. He never lived in a big city. He never traveled 200 miles from the place where he was born. He did none of the things that usually accompany greatness. He had no credentials but himself. When he was 33, the tide of public opinion turned against him. His friends ran away. One of them denied him. He was turned over to his enemies and went through the mockery of a trial. He was nailed to a cross between two thieves, and while he was dying, his executioners gambled for his garments, the only property he had on earth. When he was dead, he was laid in a borrowed grave through the pity of a friend. 20 centuries have come and gone, and today he's the central figure of the human race. I am well within the mark when I say that all the armies that ever marched, all the navies that ever sailed, all the parliaments that ever sat, all the kings that ever reigned put together have not affected the life of man on this earth as much as that one solitary life. The question through all our series is, how much is that life still affecting us? The series is just simply intended to be, as I mentioned the last time I spoke, a series of signposts to take us somewhere, to help us to know when we have arrived at that somewhere, but more importantly, to take us to someone. But where do we go when we've reached that someone? When we arrive, what then? My sister, who I mentioned, I'm very grateful that she hung on to that. How on earth it came into her position? She was 5 years older than me. She was number 6 of 8 of us. And no idea. But I'm very glad she did, because it filled in those gaps that I didn't know anything about. How many of you are familiar with this TV program? You've seen it? Yeah. It's where they choose a number of celebrities and they research their background, and then they come in and they travel around to find out who they belong to and what their ancestry was and so on and so forth. Margaret and I watched a repeat of this guy. Josh Widdicombe, comedian, very likable sort of guy. And in the course of discovering his history and his family tree, it went right the way back to Henry VIII. And there is a very, very, very great likelihood that Henry VIII, his great great-grandfather, so many times removed. He didn't only have six wives, there were... Yeah, we'll leave it there, shall we? Yeah. But for Josh Widdicombe, it kind of put a whole new perspective on something that he knew nothing about, his ancestry. To whom you belonged, your family tree, your genealogy, is very, very important still in many, many cultures around the world. And Israel was no exception to this. I just want to do a very, very brief history, so don't nod off. 733 BC, because of their idolatry and disobedience, 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel were sent into captivity in Assyria. They never came back, never heard of them again. Left just two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. The tribes that went were called Israel, the other two were just called Judah, but they eventually adopted the name of Israel for themselves. Approximately 150 years later, for the same reason, disobedience and idolatry, they're taken into captivity into Babylon. The end of the Old Testament's 14th book, 2 Chronicles, records something about this. Babylon is taken over by Persia. Now, eventually, Persia has a king called Cyrus, who is a little bit more savvy than most of them. When they take prisoners, when they take captives, they treat them badly. He didn't. He had the nous to know that if you treat people well, they will probably respond well. And that was the case. And many of them assimilated into the nation and the kingdom of Persia. About 538, he gives them the option to return home. It's not compulsory. It's optional. They can go if they want. Many had assimilated and didn't want to bother. Just didn't feel any need. So, some of them do. But among the second and third wave of these people that go back are two men called Ezra and Nehemiah. There are two books in the Old Testament that are named after them. But these two are an odd pair. To them, identity, inheritance, belonging was key. And they required, because they had official positions in all these returnees, they required other returnees to produce family records as proof of their identity and belonging, just to see if they were genuine Israelites or not. Nehemiah 7 says this: "Then my God put it into my heart to assemble the nobles and the officials and the people to be enrolled by genealogy. And I found the book of the genealogy of those who came up at the first. And I found written in it," and here it is, you can read it all together. Okay? Strings and strings and strings. Goes from verse 69 to 59. 6 to 59, sorry, of the whole thing. There's even some more, I think, on there, James, is there? Yep. There we go, if you want to try and have a read of it. But there's a problem. Some couldn't find their family records. And so Ezra then has a go. Ezra 2, he says, "The following with those who came up, though they could not prove their father's houses or their descent, whether they belonged to Israel." And once more, we can read it together. Here we go. No, maybe not. Yep. You begin to get the idea. These are trying to formulate some sense of belonging for these people. But one of the things that I must confess, I find it a little bit amusing. Ezra, there's an indication with him of how important proof really was. Ezra 7, and he says, "Now after this, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, the son of Seraiah, son of Azariah, son of Hilkiah, son of Shalom, son of Sadok, son of Ahitub, son of Amariah, son of Azariah, son of Meriath, son of Zerahiah, son of Uzi, son of Buki, son of Abishua, son of," and he goes on and concludes, "this Ezra." He's making sure that everybody knows what his ancestry and his background are. He is either mega pedantic, or he's just out to prove a point, I'm not sure which. But you get the picture, don't you? That there is something important in finding their family records. It was not unknown for some of them to doctor their historical records, to expunge the undesirable and the unsavoury, and to insert a few notables to make it look a little more respectable than it was. This is one of the things that you find when you look through, if you ever take the time to read through the Luke and the Matthew genealogies of Jesus, you find it is what it is. No tampering, because there are people in there that traditionally, culturally, should have been left out. It includes kings, it includes tyrants, includes a couple of tarts in there as well, if you read it carefully. And it's not been amended for good effect. It's not been amended to impress. Testimony is included in there of just how God can redeem and use the most flawed and imperfect people. Just by their name being in there, it's an indication of God's grace. Jesus' identity and belonging doesn't depend on Old Testament ancestral records. They're there for good effect, but it doesn't depend on them. He didn't need other people's approval, and it's just as well, because he didn't get it. From birth, Bethlehem. You wouldn't have put that scrappy little place on one of these. It means nothing back then. Really didn't. It had no significance at all. Raised in Nazareth. That place is no great shakes. When Jesus began his ministry and began to call his first disciples, in John 1, it says, "Philip found Nathanael and said to him, 'We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote,'" which is what we've been looking at over the last few weeks, "'Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph.' Nathanael said to him, 'Can anything good come out of Nazareth?'" There's almost a sneer in there, isn't there? "And Philip said to him, 'Come and see.'" Hey, good answer, Philip. Good answer. But it doesn't end there. When Jesus is into his ministry, and in Matthew 13, coming to his hometown, he taught them in their synagogue so that they were astonished. That is not a compliment, by the way, as you'll see as we go along. They said, "Where did this man get this wisdom and these mighty works? Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not this his mother called Mary? Are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And are not all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all these things?" And they took offence at him. Whatever they knew about him, whatever the record was, whatever his upbringing, they were offended by him. But Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honour except in his hometown and in his own household." Who does he think he is? He once asked his own disciples, "Who do people say I am?" But then came the crunch question, "Who do you say I am?" And that's the crunch one, isn't it, for all of us? Because the question still remains, who do we think he is? The Christian author Philip Yancey, one of the most popular Christian authors of the past probably 30 years, in one of his books he poses a question, why am I a Christian? I sometimes ask myself, and to be perfectly honest, the reasons reduced to two: the lack of good alternatives and Jesus. Brilliant, untamed, tender, creative, slippery, irreducible, paradoxically humble, Jesus stands up to scrutiny. He is who I want my God to be. And if you trace the genealogies through, if you look at some of the references that are in there, you will find that this man, Jesus, is God. And as Yancey concludes, he is who I want my God to be. It's the one that we've been tracing back through the Old Testament. He is the one in whom we find our destination. He's the one in whom we find our identity. Paul calls him the author and the finisher of our faith. He's the beginning and the end. He's the Alpha and the Omega. Everything is within him. Irrespective of any status, irrespective of any kudos that our family trees may provide, being in the family of Jesus gives us a standing that nothing else can. That standing will be challenged. It is, frequently. But it gives us a standing that nothing else can. The Apostle Paul uses a little phrase very, very frequently. Sadly, I think we have kind of turned it round in some cases, often reduced it to him, Christ, being in us. He uses the term in Christ, and he uses it a lot, in Christ, because he being in us is quite minuscule, isn't it? But us being in him, that opens up a whole new world. We are invited to enter into him, into his kingdom, into his world, into his life, into his purposes, so that we discover our place in him and all that is in his records. After all, he's not my citizen. I'm his. And that makes a world of difference. That means, as Paul said to the Roman church, we are joint heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. That is enormous. Let me just go briefly back to Israel again. Before the captivities had happened, they had also been captive in Egypt. This is right before there was any Israel, before there were any Jews. This is a family of 70 plus that belonged to Jacob, and they go by invitation into Egypt. And after 400 plus years, they find it's not as rosy as they thought it was. And the big escape for them, of course, is the Exodus. But it's no sooner do they get out than they want to go back. They are the biggest bunch of moaners that you could ever come across. They just want to go back. Some wanted to go back and settle there. Some of them wanted to settle where they were in the wilderness. And on two occasions, God through Moses says this to them, you have been round this mountain long enough. There's no going back and there's no settling. You've got to go on because I want to take you somewhere because you have a destiny. When the Apostle Paul was converted, he had to come to terms with an awful lot of things, and he made a very, very, very long and significant journey. And one point, writing to a church in Philippi, he says, I don't mean to say that I have already reached perfection, but I keep working toward that day when I will finally be all that Christ Jesus saved me for and wants me to be. Or as the New International Version puts it, to take hold. I want just to take hold of what Christ took hold of me for. You see, it's not just about getting saved, about being converted and then sitting around and waiting to go to heaven. God forbid. That must be the most boring existence you could ever think of. The initial transformation that we experience is only the beginning. Just the beginning. Our new parliament this week will discover that Thursday was just the beginning. Although everything headed for the 4th of July, it wasn't going to be Independence Day. Because the 5th of July comes after that, and then the 6th, and then the next week, and then the next month, and next year. And that's how it goes. It has to go somewhere. We heard an awful lot of manifestos over the past week or two. I want to introduce you to one that is the manifesto of Jesus. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who were oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. You will not find a better one. There is something in common between the manifestos that we have heard recently and that one, and that is that neither of them contain any original thought. If you listen to all the manifestos, it's the same old, same old, same old, churned up from somewhere else. This goes back to Isaiah chapter 61. Why? Because Jesus himself says, I can't better it. That's why on the day in the synagogue when he was passed the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, he says, he found the place where it's written. It was deliberate. Rooted firmly back into the Old Testament. But something that he did that maybe we can only see as things unravel or unfold in our nation. But one of the things that we can find here with Jesus is that he fulfilled it. And he fulfilled it to the letter. If you read the chapters that follow Luke chapter 4, you will find every bit of it being fulfilled. But here's something. He fulfilled it, but he didn't finish it. He fulfilled it, but he didn't finish it. He handed it on to those 12 bunch of reprobates that he had called apostles, and a few others who were the disciples as well. They fulfilled it and didn't finish it. They handed it on to the early church. And that's been going on for generation after generation after generation. And our identity and our destiny is to be the continuation of what he began. Let me just conclude with a made-up story. I have to emphasize that. It's made up. You won't find it anywhere in the Bible. But it does emphasize what I'm trying to say. Describes Jesus returning to heaven after his time here on earth. And the angels gather round him to find out about all that's happened. And Jesus explained how he had lived among people, shared his teachings, expressed his love, died on the cross to atone for humanity's sins, and was resurrected to declare that the new kingdom is at hand. When he had finished, Michael the archangel said, "What happens now?" Jesus answered, "I left behind a handful of faithful men and women. They will tell the story They will express the love. They will spread the kingdom. But what if they fail? Asked Michael. What will then be the plan? And Jesus answered, there is no other plan. We've traced him from Genesis, through Moses, the Psalms, the prophets, and we too have found there's no other plan. 2024, the plan still is.